This is going to be my fifth time talking about communion. Man, has he got something about communion. Yes, it's a passion. It's something that's just, even after 30 years of ministry, it's something that the Lord has been lighting up for me. And my guiding and probing question keeps coming back, what did Jesus actually want? Between the Father and himself, what did they actually want? I know what we've made of it, and I'm part of a church tradition which really has an emphasis on communion, or Eucharist as it's fashionable to refer it to. Why did he institute it? What's his backstory? One of the things I love about being a Christian is you can ask these sorts of questions. There are other faiths on the planet where you can't ask because the word of God supposedly just fell out of heaven and that's it, like it or lump it. But in Christianity, there's always this space to ask the questions. We heard a reading last week from Isaiah, where God spoke from Isaiah saying, come, let us reason together. Let's talk about this. Let's understand each other's mind. Our amazing God is like that. And then with Abraham, there's the story of haggling. How many people is it worth saving the city for? What's your bottom line, God? So, I found asking questions, why? Like a three-year-old, really fruitful in my faith. Never be afraid to do that. So, why did he institute it? In a general area of worship, we have a sort of an orientating comment from Jesus. The Father wants those who worship him to worship him in spirit and in truth. So here comes my reflection. Next picture, please. In April, I got to spend a few days with my 3.5-year-old granddaughter, Barbara, in Switzerland. And she seemed pleased to see again the grandparents they knew from screen, you know, the two-dimensional experience. And when she gets bored with us on screen, she pushes the button. Go away. It's so simple. But apparently she'd been really building up to us. She was going to meet. She refers to me as Opa and Grandma. So, and she was excited. So on the way to the cafe where we were going to meet, she picked some wildflowers. And when she saw me, she rushed in and there they were, this little bunch of wildflowers, daffodils, and it's not daffodils, dandelions and daisies and things. And then she was still really pumped up and excited, and there was this ornate doorstop in the cafe, a piece of folk art, all painted up, wedged piece of wood, and she went and grabbed that and gave that to me as well. All right, you could see what sort of space she was in. It was all cute, and we laughed, we understood. This is fantastic from a three-year-old. A bit of us in that. And the photo shows a while later where she had moved on, you know. I was no longer the joy of the moment, but I was still carrying my bunch of wildflowers as long as I could. She was bringing her worship. She was bringing her worship as she felt to do. It was spirit and truth, all right? But it came from what played in her and not from what I might want. And again, from a three-year-old, that's really cute. The moment lingered for me. I'm standing there with this goofy grin on my face, and the moment has moved on for her. She's thinking, I'm bored. I suspect God is often in a similar situation when receiving our worship. And we can be a bit like Ada. We conjure up something, we get excited, and we, here you are, God. And then sometime later, we switch on our adult mind and think, well, is that actually what the Lord wanted? And we listen. The learning curve of the Old Testament, big learning curve through many centuries. How do you worship a holy God? Our God is holy. He's not like the neighbor's God. He's not like what we might fantasize. How do you worship him? And you read right through the Old Testament, and it's a bumpy lesson. Holiness of worship, what does that require? And that relates to communion too. What is actually God wanting in this? What is on his heart? We can bring all sorts of things to it. I'm going to start digging into this with reference to a film. So I'm going to walk you through a movie. 1990 film, Coup de Ville. Has anyone seen it? Coup de Ville, it's kind of family viewing. It's safe, it's all right. But I watched this, and as I thought about it, I thought this has something to say about communion. So there's the Hollywood billboard. You like classic cars and kicking tires and road trips, it's a good film. So there's a father who has three sons. He lives on the west coast of America, and he's just learned he doesn't have long to live. Now, he has these three adult sons. They're all alienated. They're alienated from him. They're alienated from each other. And this is his life's legacy. So he devises a plan. And by the way, if you're part of a family with two, three, four brothers, you might buy into this. You understand what goes on. We love each other and we fight all the time. The father devises a plan. He buys this classic car on the east coast of America, a Coup de Ville. And just hold it there, please. That's good. He buys this classic car and he says to his sons, "Boys, I want you to bring that car from the east coast to the west coast. It's for your mama." So he says, "I bought this car for your mother because she's always wanted one. Boys, you just have to bring it from there to there. Can you do that?" That's the plot. And and you see them up there, there's dad, there's mama, and there are the boys, not looking too happy at the idea. What? I've got to spend X amount of time on the road with... So the boys are a curious bunch. One's a regimented army sergeant, and he's in uniform there. One's a dreamer, just absolutely away with it. It's totally impractical. And the third is an anti-social deviant, a crim. You put them together in this open-top classic car. And the plot unfolds as a road trip. Next screen, please. Yeah, there they are. Everything that can go wrong does go wrong. Next screen. They crash the car, of course, that's just a matter of time. The number of times they're facing law enforcement officers who say something like, "You boys in a whole heap of trouble." And then they really mess up the car. Thank you. Something goes terribly wrong. There's mama's car. Papa bought it for mama. All we had to do was bring it. And this is what happens. Trial after tribulation after trial. Next screen, please. There's some back blocks mechanic who's going to put it all back together. There they are, rustling up some money with their bottles of Coke at the coin-operated phone that we used to have last century. That's the story. But this Coup de Ville fulfills the prayer of the father. And next screen, these three brothers find each other. They grow in understanding. They learn to love each other and own each other as brothers, sometimes because they're facing some very dangerous situations. They stand together, they share their lives. They find their communion as common sons or brothers, and they fulfill the wish of their father. Next screen. The day comes, and they deliver this pristine coupe de ville to Mama, as the father had asked them to. Now, they don't know that the father has so long to live. That's not known to them. Mission accomplished. The dying father set his sons up to do something that would change, reconcile, and bond them as brothers. And the car was the means to do this. Now, Jesus is smart. You don't have to read far in the Gospels and realize he is really smart. I think he set up this shared meal in memory of him with something of this in mind. Bread and wine, a meal together. What could go wrong? But do this in memory of me. What do you think? You think I've watched one Hollywood film too many? Overthinking it? Or is there something in this? Let's talk some more. What could be hard about bringing a car from one place to another? What could be so hard about having a meal together in memory of Jesus? Well, this is what I've noticed. We as fallen people actually find it difficult to love. We want to, but we actually find it difficult. We find it difficult to be there for each other. We find it difficult to be full-on servants of our brothers and sisters. We find it hard to share life. I grew up in the flat suburbs of Christchurch. No home was complete without a 6-foot paling fence. That's the environment, the social environment I grew up in. Ross, you lived there. That's how it was. It's a bit hard to do on hills. That's where topography changes the culture of Dunedin. You can't hide from your neighbours when they're down there. Oh, what are they doing today? Or up there. It's far more accessible, transparent. Because loving and unity can be difficult, the typical human response is, yes, Jesus, we'll do it, but we'll cut corners. We'll set it up so that we don't really have to see each other or look each other or get into this touchy-feely personal accessibility business. So instead of it being an engagement with others in shared love for God, we and the church before us mystify it, ritualize it, pretty it up, individualize it, while still doing it together. It's for you, Jesus. That's the way it seems to me. That's why that story about the car is so cute. You got to get in the car. You've got to be in the space, and you've got to face everything that comes together. So I'm convinced that on the day that, and around the day that Jesus pioneered and instituted what we call Holy Communion, or the Lord's Supper, he pointed out these intentions in at least three ways. I've been over this before, but I'm going to cover it again because I just think it's so important. First of all, he gave his great commandment. That was after he demonstrated what servanthood looked like by washing feet. I mean, he only washed feet. He could have rubbed noses in it. You get this? It wasn't that brutal, though. But after he'd washed feet, he gave his great commandment. There we are. I give you a new commandment that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Context is so important. He was talking this around the time that he instituted communion. Secondly, he led his friends, including the one who would betray him, in this meal. Now, culturally, I can't overemphasize it, but for most Anglo-Saxon cultures, food is just fuel. It's calories and energy that's put in one end so that we can do what we have to do. We don't get much of the symbolic. Drive-throughs are just a typical, again, Anglo-Saxon approach to food. McDonald's in Europe couldn't resist it. They all tended to become cafes because that's what you do. You sit at table and you have service. So fast food, French or Dutch style, tended towards cafes because you've got to have the social ambience with it. You can't just pop food in one end and say that was a meal. I have a good vantage of the road from the front of our house, and the number of people working, literally driving, propping food in their mouth as they drive past, it speaks to me. It says, that's slavery. Haven't got time to have a decent lunch. Now, why do I go into all this? Because Mediterranean cultures and these cultures and the cultures of Jesus know eating was special. And eating together said something. Now, there are various anecdotes that come out of the Arab world recently, which are along the lines of someone being captured, and therefore the possession of the captor. Terrible things could happen to them. And if someone wanted to offer them protection to establish that, listen, this person, I protect this person, the way to do it was to have a piece of bread and to break it. In other words, we're going to just share some bread together. And that brought the captive into their house and into their protection. Now, that's a symbolism that would be totally lost on us. But it just opens up how powerful the cultural context is of sharing food. Jesus did that. He brought his friends into that and made himself central to that meal. So if we're only used to propping food in so we can keep going for the next few hours, we're going to miss that. But it's there. It's there. So thirdly, yes, we're two screens on now, thanks. Thirdly, he prayed, John 17, the so-called great high priestly prayer. What he really, really wanted. And we hear in this prayer, I'll just take one part because it's a long prayer and it repeats itself. Let it be I and them, you and me, that they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. The heart of Jesus. Maybe we be so into each other, may there be such a unity that the world can only conclude Jesus and the Father are one because his disciples are one. So when I draw this together, I hear again Jesus longing for his friends and his followers to be a unity of love, just as Christianity later came to understand the Trinity as a community of love. And I see him instituting a meal as the instance where this could be lived out. It could become concrete. It could be a moment that we point to and say, behold, here it is. Manifest. something to the joy of the Father and the Son. And that's what makes it worship, that it puts a smile on God's face, that it realizes the prayer of Jesus, that it offers to God what God is looking for. That's what makes it worship. If you want to get a little bit very Anglican here, we could talk about it being incarnational. Something that makes concrete and actual what is spiritual or hidden. So that's the simple answer to my question about what Jesus wants in communion. Jesus wants his friends united in love as he and the Father are united, so that the world has a convincing demonstration of the unity of the Father and the Son. That's quite a challenge. That's no walk in the park. Aren't you making it a bit difficult, Jesus? Isn't this a bit unrealistic? Because people are going to be people. Well, this is where the reality kicks in. Are we going to be people? Or are we going to hear a call to do something we can only do with God's help? The United Nations has been, I suppose, the biggest and the best attempt to have some sort of global understanding. So we're talking, what, since 1948? I don't know if you read your newspapers, but it's not going well. Still talking, but there's not much unity. The reason I say this is not to knock the United Nations, but just how hard it is to overcome the human tendency to divide, to fracture, to avoid unity. It's so simple, and yet it's so hard. But to promote this, Jesus instituted a meal. He said, "Do this in memory of me." It's so simple, and yet so profoundly wise, and we could miss it. And that's why, as I've been saying, we cut corners and we rework it to compensate our inability or unwillingness to get into the target zone. Andrew, I don't know how much of this you faced in your training as a priest, but the amount of emphasis and attention on getting it right, the right words, the right clothing, the right gestures. As if God's sitting there with a clipboard to give marks out of 10. Are they doing it right? And then that crowd down the road don't do it right. The games people play, the professional mystification that's applied to all this. When Jesus wanted something towards real unity. So, coming into land, what might be helpful? One big shift in thinking that might really help is recognizing the body, the congregation, as the body of Jesus. Now, at this point, you need a big mirror, because the church isn't set up to illustrate this. You're looking at me and I'm looking at you. But to recognize the body, we need to look at us. And that's why I suggest the mirror here. I come and stand over there. This is us. And I'm talking about recognizing us as the body of Christ. Now, I'm not getting super spiritual or metaphysical here, but it's recognizing that what holds these members together, what links, what inbreeds, what makes us church, is Jesus. And that's quite different from thinking, well, we're a whole lot of individuals who walk in the door and we're having a nice church service and we'll have a lovely social time afterwards. Language I've actually heard, not here, but elsewhere. But that's the mindset. So I'm saying, discerning the body. Paul talks about this in Corinthians. If we come here as individuals to make our own devotions, we will miss this. Again, a little lie in the language. Did you go to church this morning? Innocent question. Well, church is a building. Yes, you went there. Did Jesus want you to go to church? No. He wants us to be church. And discerning the body is that transition, that recognition that, you know, around this table or being together in whatever, you know, way we are, right now in our being, we are church. Where Jesus constituted in lives transformed in him. Now, you don't have to be a saint or a monk or a monastic or sit in the desert for 30 years to get this. But it's the drop zone. It's actually the target zone where Jesus, what he was pointing to. And I'm trying to get it back onto our radar, so to speak. So discerning the body, that we together are the vessel of Jesus present in the world. And that's in part why we take him into ourselves as spiritual food and a shared meal. One of the things I like about receiving, and from as a child when I received the wine, because I didn't drink a lot of wine as a kid, but at communion, there's a sense of something exciting going down your esophagus. It's very carnal, isn't it? It's physical, it's meant to be. But it sort of speaks to me of taking something warm and special and powerful into myself. So there are some alternative pieties in operation. I want to speak to one about individual devotions. Some cultivate communion as a place of devotion to the cross of Christ. And that sounds really good, but I've been pondering. Where does Jesus call for that? Doesn't Jesus tell us to take up our cross? His cross was a once-er. He even said, it's finished, it's done. Our cross is our ongoing business. And it's on our cross that we, as Paul talks about, we may participate with Christ in his cross. Communion is the fellowship meal of those who share this life. If you want to follow me, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow. We're living that life. And in that life, there is a camaraderie, a solidarity, a common life. Communion that is portrayed to us in the breaking and the pouring of Christ for us. It's quite challenging. Now, for about 1,000 years, this was considered so challenging that the only place you could realize this is a monastery or a convent. So if you got this and you thought, yes, I want this, well, you can't do this if you're a peasant farmer, can you? You can't do this if you're a a warrior king. And so those in monasteries and convents got to do this. Until the Reformation, when it was realized that actually, Jesus isn't just for monks and nuns. You should be able to live this out in the hurdy-burdy of everyday life. But it's challenging. It would be so much easier to focus on the trimmings, the prayers said, the songs sung, the order and the reverence. But Jesus gave us this gutsy challenge. Do what I do here for me and my Father. I'm pioneering this in ways that the coming hours will show the depth of. I'm referring to the cross the next day. Do this as a way to remember me. And just to repeat a word study we've done before, for centuries people thought, oh, remember, that means, you know, as an antidote to amnesia, because we might forget. Yes, we do forget. But it's not just remembering as in telling yourself. No, it's remembering as in entering into a moment, entering into a reality so that it's present. And that reality is Christ. He pointed to this with an earlier saying, where two or more are gathered in my name, I am with you. In the name. So where two or more are gathered with the intention of being in the personality, in the mind, in the heart, in the purpose of Jesus, he promises to be there. There's something about people gathered in the name or obeying the commands or seeking to fulfill the prayer of Jesus that just draws them like bees to honey. I'll be there. And so it is with communion, and I experience that. Sometimes here in this space, it's like reality just thickens up and I know, Jesus, you're here. It's like gravity has changed and the atmosphere has changed. And I conclude something of heaven is in this place. Why? Because we're standing together in the name, in response to what Jesus has commanded and provided. To do this well, we need to discern ourselves as his body. Now, discern doesn't just mean claim or rebadge or add a strap line to our stationery or something like that. No, it's actually recognizing the extent to which Jesus makes us, us. Jesus makes us, us. So, to land softly, think about being cooped up in a car with two or three others for the longest road trip. Even people that you would not choose to travel with. Jesus invites us to a table, presents himself as bread and wine, and says, share this. The Bible can be incredibly minimalist at times. Share this. And they share. How'd they do that? Did they line up? Did they stand in a circle? Did they pass the plate around? Doesn't matter. So, thank you for listening so intently. Hope I've pointed ahead to features and dimensions of communion that may open up something new for us to really draw closer to what Jesus wanted and what his desire is in this.